Welcome to the next edition of Grid Forward Chats. I'm Bryce Yonker. Today we have with us David Springy. David is with NASUCA. I'll let him define his acronym, which is a great and important one coming from the other side of the country. David, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, David, tell us a little bit about your background, the role that you have there, and some briefly on what led you to this position, this post.
Sure. So just to start off, NASUCA is the National Association of State Utility Consumer Advocates. Quite a mouthful. That's why we go by NASUCA. But if you think about NARUC and the commissioners, NARUC being statutory regulators, all of my members are statutory consumer advocates. We are created in at least 43 states by statute to show up in utility rate cases in front of the Public Utility Commission and represent consumers in those processes. So we are the state statutory advocates. I spent 22 years in Kansas, both at the PUC and the State Consumer Advocates Office, which is called the Citizens Utility Ratepayer Board. Spent the last 13 years running. I was the consumer counsel for the Kansas Consumer Advocate, and was active in the association. NASUCA was the association. I was the association president in 2007 to 2009. So I spent the country touring. That was right when the ARRA money came out under the Obama administration. And so smart grid and smart meters were all anybody wanted to talk about. So I talked about those for 2 years. Anyways, went back to Kansas to do my day job, and they called me up in 2015 and asked if I would come out to Washington, D.C. and run the association. So I made that hop. So I've been running NASUCA since 2015.
Great. I think you already covered this in your introduction, but let's just cover it quickly. What is the role of a consumer advocate, and why do organizations with this focus exist?
Yeah, so we exist because historically, really in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of coal plants and nuclear plants that had a few cost overrun issues. And usually when you get some sort of a cost overrun like that, the first thing the politicians do is look around and go, well, who's representing consumers? And it was recognized that there was really no one in these processes that had the technical ability, the legal skills, and the time and energy to go in there and really represent consumers. I mean, you know, most of us have a day job. People don't have time to think about their utility rates. But we exist really, if you think about it in its simpler sense, to be due process for residential, small business customers, or whoever our different offices represent. Each state's slightly different in who they represent and how it's set up. But the core is we show up. We review utility filings, we intervene, we provide evidence, we testify, we cross-examine, we write briefs. And core to our mission and our membership is that we have the due process ability to take a commission order to court. You know, very few people have that real ability to come in and do this job and take an order to court. So at its core, we are the due process arm for consumers in this process, so that we have the same rights and abilities, access to courts that the utilities do.
So let's talk a little bit about decision making and information sharing. I know this is complicated and can go in a lot of paths, mm-hmm. but can you talk a little bit about the process for making significant grid investments, the information that you and other parties get, and kind of how does this process work?
So, you know, every state's going to be a little bit different in terms of how they go about it. So, I mean, historically, the utilities would just go spend money and every 3 or 4 years would come in for a rate case and say, here's what I spent. Obviously, that changed historically. Some states got into doing formalized integrated resource planning dockets, which looked at all of your resource needs, both generation needs, generation alternatives like demand side options, energy efficiency, and then some of your grid needs to meet those. So some states did that. The reality is a lot of states don't have any sort of formalized planning process at the distribution level. So when you're talking about the lines running up and down the streets or laterals or, you know, 65 kV lines here and there, a lot of states don't have sort of a formalized planning process for those. So what you end up in a lot of those states for grid planning purposes is a docket. utilities will file some sort of a docket that says, I want to put in smart meters and I want to spend this amount of money, or I want to put in, do these sorts of grid integrated upgrades, fancier technology, line replacements, reconductoring, those types of things. So it'll come down to a discrete proceeding that we will be involved in and go forward. And so those are fairly common. We've had those all over the country. The newer sort of version is a lot of states have moved into some sort of they fall under the moniker of performance-based rate plans, but a lot of states have forward-looking test years, or they'll plan 3 years forward. So now you're having a process that sort of sets the spending levels for utilities going forward for 3 years and gives them some rate certainty around what's going to happen. It gives us some certainty around what investments are being looked at and planned for. So there's several paths. Some states, again, don't have any sort of formal planning process at the distribution grid level. And then it sort of works its way up to states that have a maybe more advanced process that's looking forward for several years and trying to plan for those.
Yeah. So you laid out a number of various options there. So maybe either with examples or just in general, what would you say is complicating the progress for accelerating grid investments? Or how does it look to take those investments forward, maybe in a couple of those different regulatory environments that you just ran through?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I think one of the, there's two probably big challenges. One is just sort of figuring out what's actually needed. One of the things that we learned during the ARRA money and the Obama administration is we bought a lot of technology, really fancy meters, and nobody ever used them, right? Like they were going to read meters and give rate plans and do a lot of things. And really the technology was historically underutilized. So there's this question when these cases come up now, when we look at them, we go, well, what are you actually buying? What do you actually intend to use it for? What's the consumer benefit of spending this money? I mean, what are you going to do with it? And how do we make sure that you're actually going to do those things? So that becomes kind of the core issue. How do you intend to use the technology? What is the cost-benefit ratio? Where do consumers actually see the usage? Because again, that was overlooked historically. We had a lot of smart meters that went in and they just read them once a month, like the old meters we had. We spent a lot of money to read a meter once a month. I will say that we learned a lot during that period, and we much better understand the functionality and the capabilities of these technologies now. So I think that's not necessarily a problem today, but it's part of when we look at cases, it's part of what we remember. So we are very concerned about sort of what's the underlying cost-benefit ratio, how are consumers going to see it. The second piece is, in this day and age, there's a lot of sort of build to the future, right? So it's the field of dreams kind of thing. We are looking forward and we're trying to anticipate, well, where is EV load going to show up? Where is electrification really going to push forward? Where are these things going to happen and how do we build to that? So there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of really what is needed and how much we're going to have to spend. And you know, we're not inclined to spend a lot of money on spec, right? The utilities make money putting infrastructure in the ground, and you know, we don't want them to do that willy-nilly or on spec. So trying to figure out, again, how to get our hands around what is actually going to be needed and useful as we go into, like, what's our joint and shared vision of the future, and then how do we meet that?
All right, maybe two more we'll call level setting here. So yeah. Clearly you would like it to be even more so, but it, you know, the narrative is that the voice of the customer and the community is always said to be in mind. But in your perspective, how much would you say that key grid infrastructure efforts do really consider those impacts to those communities and those customers? Or if it's not as much as you'd like, how do we help advance really having that voice of the customer be more effective in these decisions?
It is always, especially around the areas of technology and planning for the future, it's especially difficult to have conversations with the community writ large. First and foremost, most people in the community don't want to think about it, don't care. They just want their lights on and they just want their bills low. And they care about that. So they don't think about it. But when you start trying to get out into the community, and one, talk to, let's say, the environmental groups that are very concerned about using our grid efficiently and using it to bring DERs on or renewable technologies. That's a separate conversation than, say, the people that are concerned with equity and social justice or low income rates or what these technologies can or cannot do and what the rate impacts are going to be with those. So it's always a very difficult conversation to get out there and really kind of get, again, that sort of shared vision, because a lot of people have different agendas on what they want. I will tell you, a lot of our advocate offices, we look at it maybe a little more narrowly. We still sort of operate under the basic economic, the premise that we're economic regulators, right? The goal is to meet load. We want reliability, meet the load, lowest reasonable cost, right? So again, it's somewhat less altruistic in some respects. And we're really just trying to figure out what is the thing that we need to build and why. And so, again, having that conversation in the community can be difficult. Trying to meet everybody's needs is impossible. So again, it's an interesting balance to try and do that communication.
Yeah. And then maybe my last one here before we'll dive into some of the deeper topics would just be kind of regional differences. You guys work across mm-hmm. the country. Everybody, right. as you had said, is looking for cost-effective, reliable energy that, for the most part, they don't have to think about. But what are some of the main dynamics in play that might be different as you look across the country in different regions or geographies or communities?
I think probably one of the chief drivers today that determines things regionally or as we move across the country is sort of the position of the state policy on decarbonization. In fact, there's arguably sort of been a move away from our historic economic role, which is, again, meeting, let's define the load, meet the load, lowest reasonable cost, keep the lights on, to now in some states being much more focused on a decarbonization goal. So it's not necessarily meeting load, it is meeting low emissions. And that's a very different objective function when you start looking at the technologies and the things that you need to meet that. So that is a pretty big breakdown. And you know, again, it breaks down sometimes by resource, historic resource mix. So the states that have a lot of gas or the states that have historically had coal tend to be less focused on some of the emissions type goals. Others are very focused on emissions. So again, that's going to dictate sort of where you put your investment and what your objective function is. So I think you can talk about a lot of sort of regional differences, but in my mind, like the chief driver, the chief thing sort of separating states right now is that focus on emission policy.
Yeah. Well, let's take it there. So, you know, I have that policy drivers are really kind of requiring energy transition accelerate in a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. You could put other dynamics into what the policy mm-hmm. drivers are trying to achieve, but I think that's a core one. And often replacement assets for energy supply rarely come in like for like, right? What's going offline rarely looks like what's coming online. And how would you say that this is impacting customers in general, or if there's a few examples, some perspectives that you all have on that front?
Yeah. So, you know, interestingly, I'm not sure at this point it has impacted customers a whole lot. I mean, if you look really across the regions, for the most part, even though we've shifted from a lot of fossil based baseload type resources that have historically made up our generation mix, as we've been bringing those off, we've been bringing on renewable technologies and other things. So far, we've, I think, managed to keep things in reasonable balance. I know that NERC has issued some concerns going forward, and certainly, you know, the regional planners are concerned going forward about making sure we keep that balance. But so far, I don't know that the average customer, other than maybe, you know, there's been, obviously, depending on where you're at, there's been some bill impacts based on the technology or policies that the state may be pursuing, but historically, you know, they're not that huge. I do worry, I will say that, you know, looking forward, I'm much, much more worried about things, you know, what everybody's talking about now. And again, this is less of a grid thing, but if you look upstream, the the load necessary to serve data centers, the load necessary, the generation necessary to serve the car plants, battery plants, chip manufacturing in the Northwest. You know, I guess we're fortunate in one sense to have a resurgence of manufacturing in the U.S., but to meet those load requirements is really going to be quite an undertaking. And this is, I think, as we move forward, where customers are really going to feel the bite, both as some of the generation resources that we already have on the system get shifted over to meet that load. And we have to, again, still keep ramping up the rest of our transmission system and our distribution systems in ways that are able to handle that. And that really doesn't even talk that much about, you know, if we get down into the distribution system level, you have that same sort of picture as you start looking at EV load growth as we go forward. So again, there's sort of like this, what I would consider by historical standards, extraordinary load growths or requirements that the utilities are going to have to meet. And that's going to take a lot of resource expenditure. And you know, those come with rate impacts on consumers, bill impacts.
Yep. So in many parts of the country, grid assets are coming near their useful life. And we could think about generation assets, but I'm largely thinking about grid infrastructure, transmission and distribution infrastructure that's coming near its useful life. And as you well know, replacement is not inexpensive. How do you see this trend going forward? Can we keep the grid whole and healthy and reliable? What sort of cost impacts might that have?
I think we certainly can keep the lights on. We can replace all of this. We can upgrade it. Again, if we can get that sort of shared vision of where the load is going to go and how we build to that load so that we can build more efficiently and get the best bang for our buck in terms of what we're doing, and reconductoring or redoing poles or whatever we're doing. Yeah, I think we can do it. It is going to be expensive. There's no question. Consumer rates are going to be impacted. And again, there's two different tranches, right? There's the, wait, we just got to replace a lot of old stuff that's just end of useful life. And we also have to still build a whole layer over and above to meet the new needs, the EV load, the electrification load, the things that are happening, you know, people putting solar panels and batteries in their house, and that battery capability is becoming more affordable. That sort of ability to move power in and out of a system instead of one way down a line takes a different set of technologies. It's exciting in one sense what the technologies are going to do for consumers, but it's also, you know, it's going to be expensive and a little bit terrifying when the bill comes due.
And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about, was the rate pressure. You know, some locations are seeing 10 or even upwards of 20% rate increases. In a modernized grid, how do we balance the outcome of replacing assets, building new assets to meet new load, with ensuring affordability?
Yeah. So that's sort of the ultimate question, right? I mean, I could be flip and just say, look, we can't. Affordability is going to be challenged as we go forward, as we've never seen before, just because we have to make these types of investments. There's no way that we can do this and keep rates affordable for everyone. I think one of the things that I talk about when I go to talk to, you know, with NARUC in different places is we tend to not have a good concept of what affordability means. And I'm not going to tell you what, but we tend to get to the end of a rate case and go, oh my gosh, rates have gone up a whole lot and we need to do something to help the low income or help with affordability. And so we'll create, you know, some sort of a low income rate or a payment and based on income plan. We'll create something that addresses that after the fact, as opposed to defining up front what affordability means and then using that definition as you look at your infrastructure build plan. So, you know, maybe you're a state and you go through a process and you say, look, 6% of household incomes is the right sort of affordability standard for utilities. You at least have a guidepost as you go forward of what you should or shouldn't approve or what it's going to do in terms of affordability. But we tend to get it backwards. Whatever gets invested in, the rate impacts, and then we go, oh my gosh. So I try and get people to, one, think about affordability sooner in the process and use that as a tool to measure what it is that you're going to build. But the second piece of this too, and this is, I think, an exciting area, depending on who you ask, some people will be less excited about it. But, you know, some of the new meters and the technology that we are putting in does give consumers the ability to be more active in their own usage and control their own bills. So we've spent a lot of time this year talking about time varying rates. And again, there's, you know, it's like Baskin Robbins, right? There's 31 flavors or whatever out there, but getting consumers to be aware of and then participate in managing their usage to the extent they can and giving them rate structures that provide them savings if they can move usage off of those peak periods where time is strained, or move usage into periods where we have a lot of excess. So California has a lot of solar in the middle of the day, right? So you want people to use power in the middle of the day. In Kansas, we have a lot of wind power in the middle of the night. So, you know, what can we charge up in the middle of the night so that it's there? But getting consumers aware of and educated about these options, and then giving them the ability to influence their own bill by managing their use and hopefully thereby managing the system more efficiently overall. If we can get that sort of engagement with consumers, then it sort of bends the curve down a little bit on what we're going to need in the future. If we continue with sort of dumb rates and people could just plug things in whenever they want and they don't have to be, then we'll ultimately have to build more than we could if we ran the grid more efficiently. So again, the technology cuts two ways. It's going to cost money, but it also provides an opportunity for consumers to be more involved in their bills and their affordability at home.
Costly distribution upgrades, frequent extreme weather events, demand surging from an onslaught of distributed energy resources adoption. Do these challenges sound familiar? If so, you need Virtual Peaker's cloud-based distributed energy platform. We're empowering modern utilities with the tools needed in the new energy landscape. The Virtual Peaker platform unifies all aspects of DER management, from DERMS to customer engagement and demand forecasting. Learn more at virtual-peaker.com.
I think you covered a lot of it, but, you know, dumb rates on a smart grid is not a good outcome. So how do we scale flexible demand, flexible use from customers? How do we scale that in jurisdictions so that it has a meaningful impact, right? They're not rounding errors. They're not some side project that get put on a shelf and, we proved we could do it. But how does it get deployed as a commercial scale solution alongside what, you know, planners for an IRP are thinking about for you know, utility scale generation, and dispatchers are thinking about what are my next resources that they can push a button on? How do we get it into that category of resources so it makes an impact?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting and painful, I think. What we have seen is a number of states more recently have moved to sort of mandatory time of use rates, right? And that's, I kind of look at that as sort of baby step number one, right? We're going to do time of use rates. We're going to get customers across the board to start thinking about when cost is expensive, or excuse me, when power is expensive and when power is inexpensive. And again, a lot of those discussions is focused around residential customers or maybe small commercial customers. But I do think that goes all the way up the line, right? I mean, at some level, we can tell you the locational marginal cost of a kilowatt hour everywhere on the system, you know, every minute of the day, right? So somewhere we have to figure out a way to incorporate those sort of daily fluctuations and hopefully maybe the technology that understands those fluctuations to help us manage our load. But again, I think the first and baby step is let's get consumers thinking about this. There's a debate right now going on about whether time of use type rates should be mandatory with an opt out or voluntary with an opt in. I will tell you, our NASUCA policy is opt-in because we don't think customers should be forced. But I will tell you that I'm not sure that is going to get us where we need to go. And so a number of states out there and a number of my member offices have adopted the position of these time of use type rates should be mandatory and we should move forward. It's a lot of debate around this, but it's interesting when you start, you know, more recently, Missouri, Michigan, Colorado. So, you know, not states that you would think about as being on the coast or on the vanguard of you know, emissions policy and that kind of stuff. I mean, but states are really seeing this as an opportunity and that we have the technology for that we should use. The technology, as I said when I started this, if we have the technology, let's use it to its maximum benefit and use it in a way that hopefully saves most customers money and hopefully saves the system writ large over time, the need to build resources. So it's an exciting sort of moment to be able to go down that point.
Let's touch on the federal resources. It's not an insignificant amount of money that's coming from the grants, loans, rebates, and other incentives, some going directly to consumers, obviously a lot going to infrastructure providers. Do you see these efforts being able to have an impact on affordability and have an impact on consumers in an effective fashion? And if so, kind of how and when?
Yeah. So I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag. So let's start from the ground up, consumers, sort of like the home energy rebates and those types of things. I think that can help a lot of consumers. But again, so a lot of those depend on sort of your tax status, right? So there's a lot of those out there that functionally aren't going to be usable to the average consumer. You're not deducting, you know, enough, or you're not really able to take advantage of those. And really the people that we're really concerned about affordability, sort of the low income or the seniors or those types of people, they're really not in a position to take advantage of some of that stuff anyway. So absent, you know, I worry that some of the consumer, like the bottom end consumer stuff, while certainly some people will take advantage of it, I don't know if it's going to move the needle a lot. I'm more optimistic about some of the new efficiency, like this, you know, industrial efficiency sort of stuff on washers and dryers and those kinds of things, because I think that moves the load writ large over time in much more impactful ways. As I think you move up the challenge, I've not seen one of the things that we tend to look at and argue with our utilities is about whether they are accessing the full amount of money that might be possible to help reduce the costs of the resources that the utilities need to meet some of these growing loads. And there's some opportunities out there, but I think even the utilities are somewhat reluctant around taking those. I mean, all of that money comes with a lot of strings and sometimes is structured in a way that doesn't help maybe maximize what it could be. And then the third chunk of money is really incentivizing private industry to do things, right? It's tax credits for renewables. It's tax credits for private industry to do things that will ultimately show up in the market. So the question is over time, is that actually reducing the cost to consumers, or is it actually going to increase the cost as we have to sort of build the infrastructure to meet these new private sector people that are taking advantage of tax credits? So I will say it's you know, one, it's a lot of money. And so I can't even confess to having my head around all the money and all the programs that are going on out there. It is really amazing. I think if it does nothing else, it definitely impacts sort of the culture and the focus and the trajectory that we as a country are going down. I mean, it's, you know, they talk about, you know, government being this giant battleship that takes a long time to turn. I mean, I feel like that, you know, while I might look at any individual piece of this and go, maybe good, maybe not as good as I'd hoped for, the writ large is definitely turning the needle. It's definitely pushing more resources over to deal with emissions, to make reliability better, to help renewables, to get new technologies online. So I think it's positive. I'm going to say the jury's out on whether I think that's ultimately going to be good for the consumer bottom line when we get our bill of the mail every month or not.
Well, I have a lot of other topics I want to cover with you. Can we do like a semi rapid fire? So just kind of quick if you can on a couple different topics here. There's a lot of developments in markets across the country as they take next steps to bringing resources in potentially wider geographic areas. What role do you think markets can play with regard to customers? Where's that overlap? And is there areas that you think it benefits the end consumer much?
So this is an interesting question because it's not necessarily the concept of markets that is bad, but it's sometimes the execution of the markets. And so I will say that we have some states that don't have RTOs in existing markets. Let's down in the Southeast or out in the West. And they're not super excited about them. And not that the market per se is better or worse than traditional regulatory processes. It's that usually when you set up a market, the market is run by one of the regional transmission organizations or the ISOs. Where at the state level, we have some voice in the process, we start losing our voice when you go to a MISO or a PJM or one of those. Suddenly, consumers really have little voice. The RTOs tend to be sort of captured and beholden to, even though they're ostensibly supposed to be independent, we kind of all know they really aren't. They cater to the needs of the transmission owners. And so they don't necessarily do the things that we as customers always think. And again, we don't have a say in them. So if you're in a state that's talking about moving to an RTO in a market, you know, as a consumer advocate, you have to weigh that against whether whether what that market may bring in terms of entry is better than what we lose in terms of local control. It's a hard question. So again, there's pluses and there is minuses and whether you want to go down that path, I'm going to leave up to my individual states.
And the last kind of topic here would be resiliency. We've covered it almost every podcast we've had in the last 4 years. Yeah. The frequency and impact of disturbances and disruptions is just coming at communities rapid fire. And it often has disproportionate impact on more vulnerable audiences. So from your perspective, advocating for the voice of the consumers, you know, how do we address resiliency investments effectively? How do we address them cost effectively? Any thoughts or responses on that?
Yeah, that's super difficult just because it's, you know, resiliency being so different than reliability, right? Like that ability to come back up after a storm. I think it's an area where technology can provide some solutions. One of the things we definitely know is that we can design a system that has algorithms that can act to reschedule power or reroute power faster than us humans can get there, right? So I think that there's some good things about that, but at some level, it really is a level of hardening in a sense. It seems that the storms are getting more frequent and more powerful. And so the events tend to have bigger impact. And then of course, we as a society are becoming larger and more dependent on our wire. So there's more stuff out there for the storms to affect that runs downhill. So, you know, I don't know what the right answer is. Again, like the engineering answer is yes, we could fix this, but under no circumstance could we probably afford what the engineers would do to fix that, right? I mean, so you've got to draw that balance somewhere. I do think, again, once you get sort of the time of use type rates and consumers more involved in the system, I think consumers can also start looking at DER type technologies in their home, right? So you become a little less vulnerable. I think that we have some obligation to make sure that is translating down to the customers that are least able to afford it and often most affected. I mean, we have to have a special focus to make sure that they are getting access to these technologies, or that we're making the investments in those areas that actually help them and bring them on. I will also say, though, that there's storms. Yes, there are storms, there are wildfires, and there are things that we're just going to have to sort of figure out how to work around. But a lot of the disruptions that we've seen, like the big disruptions, really have been more sort of generation related, whether it's, you know, a vortex freezing off gas or, you know, I mean, the vortex also freeze coal piles, people don't realize that, but a lot of the coal plants that you think are running aren't running because their coal plant, their coal pile out in the yard has been rained on and iced over. So they're not shoving coal into that plant either. So some of it really too is making sure that we have a redundancy of generation that, you know, can cover and deal with it. And then finally, obviously, the topic everyone's talking about is more transmission lines so that we have the ability, or more ability, I should say, than we have today of moving power from one region of the country to another region when it's necessary. So, again, I think all of those are we're capable of doing all those. All of those will increase and improve resilience, being able to bring the system back up in the face of these events. But those, again, are also, you know, more dollar signs added on.
Well, David, thank you for your perspectives. Keep up the great work there at Nasuka, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks again to our season sponsor, Virtual Peaker. If you enjoy Grid Forward Chats, please follow us on your favorite podcast platform, give us a like or a review, and tell your colleagues. You can listen to all episodes and learn more about our efforts to advance the grid at gridforward.org.